Please join me in Isaiah chapter 34, where the prophet Isaiah, prophesying in the late 8th century BC, has things to say about his time period, about the time period leading up to the first coming of the Messiah, but also about things related to the second coming of the Messiah and the judgment that is involved in the day of the Lord. And sometimes it's tough to sort out exactly which one is being communicated about in the pages of Isaiah. And my suspicion is that often it's all of them. It's kind of a mixed sort of prediction, and that it's intended to be useful at each of the time periods of history that it can be applied to. And this section right here has some things that are clearly tied into the book of Revelation with the day of the Lord, the 3.5-year period of confrontation that precedes the second coming of Jesus as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And I must confess to you, there are some things here that I think is not, they're not going to make perfect sense until we have gotten through that second coming event. And then I believe some of these things will make much more sense. Isaiah chapter 34, Isaiah writes, "Draw near, O nations, to hear, and give attention, O peoples. Let the earth hear, all that fills it, the world, all that comes from it." So everybody pay attention. "For he who is enraged against all the nations and furious against all their host. He has devoted them to destruction, has given them over for slaughter." Now that definitely is true in the time of Isaiah, because we've got the Assyrians sweeping over the Middle East as part of God's judgment against the sinful peoples of that day. Within about a century and a half, the Babylonians are going to sweep through and do something similar because God is using them. But we know that the day of the Lord will also be a time of judgment where God is sorting things out before the Messiah returns. And when this judgment is happening, there is a lot of death and destruction. Verse 3 says, "Their slain shall be cast out, the stench of their corpses shall rise, the mountains shall flow with their blood." That's a description of the unpleasantness of war and death that attends war. Verse 4, though, is the one that we were closing on yesterday, that is alluded to by Jesus. It's brought up in the book of Acts as well, but it shows up in the book of Revelation. It says, "All the host of heaven shall rot away, and the skies roll up like a scroll. All their hosts shall fall as leaves fall from the vine, like leaves falling from the fig tree." And of course, we know when the sixth seal is broken, at the beginning of the final 3.5 years before Jesus comes back, the sun's going to go dark. The moon is going to be blood red. The stars are going to be falling from the sky, not as in those great big balls of fire that are many, many light years away, but rather the angels themselves will be falling from the unseen world. Satan and his angels, according to Revelation chapter 12, will be booted out of the heavenly realm into this physical realm. And they will look like falling stars as they enter our plane of existence. And the powers of the heavens will be shaken as this final 3.5-year period begins. And that seems to tie this passage to the book of Revelation. And so I think some of these things we're about to read are likely to happen in connection with the book of Revelation events. Verse 5, for my sword has drunk its fill in the heavens. Behold, it descends for judgment upon Edom, upon the people I have devoted to destruction. Now, Edom is a very specific people group. It's also a very specific geographical location. It's to the southeast of the Dead Sea. And during the 8th century BC and afterward, the Edomites became troublemakers for the Judean kingdom and therefore came under the judgment of God. And we will see other books that are entirely devoted to the warnings of God's judgment against Edom. But the word Edom, when it's written in ancient Hebrew without any type of vowel pointing, can also represent Adam or mankind. And we know that the judgment of God will eventually come against mankind. So I think there's lots of playing on multiple applications here in the language. He who is has a sword. It is sated with blood. It is gorged with fat. I've shared with you before that swords are pictured in ancient Middle Eastern poetry, Hebrew, in particular I'm thinking about, as having two mouths because they're two-edged. And these swords eat up and drink up the life force of those that they are used against. So God is bringing judgment upon Edom, upon mankind itself, through death and destruction. Oh, it's sated, it's gorged with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For he who is has a sacrifice in Bozrah, a great slaughter in the land of Edom. And so we have a sacrifice that's taking place through the judgment, because sacrifices are about giving up blood for sin. So here is God carrying out a sacrifice of sinners. Verse 7, wild oxen shall fall with them, young steers with the mighty bulls. Their land shall drink its fill of blood, and their soil shall be gorged with fat. So a lot of death and destruction, apparently centered to the southeast of the promised land, which is interesting because in the book of Revelation, we will have references back to this portion of the book of Isaiah that seem to connect Jesus' second coming with him arriving at Mount Zion, that is, at the area of Jerusalem, already covered in the blood of those that he's brought judgment against. And that seems to be from this area southeast of Israel. And the only thing that I can come up with in my studies and in my kind of wrestling with this is that from the book of Revelation, we know that when the two witnesses are finally killed by the final world ruler and the beast leader and the false prophet, that when they rise from the dead 3.5 days later and are caught up to the heavens, that Jerusalem is broken up by a great big earthquake. And the book of Zechariah also jumps in here at this point and seems to indicate that there's going to be the opening up of a new valley east of Jerusalem, where the Mount of Olives used to be. And here's the kicker. People will be evacuating from Jerusalem through that valley eastward toward what we call the Dead Sea Valley right now. and they will be escaping the horrible attacks of the beast leader's army, along with the forces of the false prophet. If they turn right after they get through this valley, this new valley, it will take them down into ancient Edom. And now some have come up with the idea that they're looking for salvation at a place called Petra. And so that's the same area that we're talking about. And there's whole books that are written on this idea that some of the saints will escape to Petra and be protected there. But I think it's just as possible that the beast leader and the armies of the false prophet will catch up with these guys and slaughter them. And that Jesus will show up and avenge them first thing at the site of their slaughter. And if that's the case, then we're looking here at ground zero of God's judgment at the time of the second coming of Jesus. Listen to this, verse number 8. For he who is has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. And the streams of Edom shall be turned into pitch, and her soil into sulfur. Her land shall become burning pitch. Night and day it shall not be quenched. Its smoke shall go up forever from generation to generation. It shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever. Now that language, if you take that very literally, it sounds like a description of hell itself. And if that's the case, then it almost seems as if the ancient site of Edom becomes the centerpiece. Maybe we could use it this way, the opening into the eternal place of hell. And it's all because that's where Jesus carries out his first retribution against the armies of those that took the name of the beast and the number of his name and worshiped according to the dictates of the false prophet. Now, that's all speculative. Everybody, I hope, understands that. But it is interesting that this language shows up in the book of Revelation as the judgment of God falls against those that took the beast name. But back to the description here, that Edom itself, the place southeast of the Promised Land, will be a permanent ruin and desolation. Verse 11, the hawk and the porcupine, don't know that it's necessarily a porcupine. Language, the Hebrew language is sometimes a little hard to sort out as to very precise animals in mind here. But the hawk and the porcupine shall possess it. The owl and the raven shall dwell in it. Basically, wild animals, not people, will live in this region hereafter. He, meaning God, shall stretch the line of confusion over it and the plumb line of emptiness. Its nobles, there's no one there to call it a kingdom, and all its princes shall be nothing. So it ceases to be a kingdom. It ceases to be a populated place. Thorns shall grow over its strongholds, nettles and thistles in its fortresses. It shall be a haunt of jackals and abode for ostriches. We've actually seen that language before. These are just noisy wild animals. Wild animals shall meet with hyenas, and wild goats shall cry to its fellow. Indeed, there the nightbird settles and finds for herself a resting place. There the owl nests and lays and hatches and gathers her young in her shadow. Indeed, there the hawks are gathered, each one with her mate. Seek and read from the book of He Who Is. Not one of these shall be missing. None shall be without her mate. For the mouth of He Who Is has commanded, and his spirit has gathered them. So the judgment against this place is certain. It's coming from God. He has cast the lot for them. His hand has portioned it out to them with a line, they shall possess it forever from generation to generation, they shall dwell in it. So God's judgment appears to fall ultimately upon this region southeast of Israel. That will be a permanent desolation. In contrast to that, God will bring beauty back to the land of Israel. Chapter 35, the wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy in singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. Now, you remember earlier, we saw drought and shriveling of vegetation came upon those sorts of places because of the judgment of God. Here, it's the reverse. God's glory comes and brings greenness and majesty back to these places. They shall see the glory of He who is the majesty of our God. And we know that the Apostle John talks about Jesus being the ultimate glory of He who is. And so this may in fact be, and I actually believe it is, a reference to the millennial kingdom once Jesus arrives as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Verse 3, strengthen the weak hands, make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God, He will come and save you. Now that phrasing shows up in the book of Revelation about Jesus, about how He is the Lord God Himself coming with vengeance and recompense, and how He is coming to save His saints and to give them their new bodies and bring them into the eternal kingdom. And that means changes for people who have had bodily afflictions. Verse 5, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped, then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. Now, some of the people living at the first coming of Jesus that were blind did get their eyesight back. Some of the deaf got their hearing back. Some of the lame got their capabilities back because Jesus stepped in and helped them miraculously. But that did not happen across the board for everyone. That will happen at the second coming of Jesus when all handicaps of the righteous will be removed and they will have their brand new bodies. For water breaks forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of the jackals where they lie down, the grass shall become reeds and rushes. This is all a description of the new heaven and new earth where the curse is reversed. And the drought-stricken areas are now wonderfully watered places of abundance. That's all to be expected in the millennial period, and we've seen other passages about that. And speaking of other passages, there have been other places that talked about this highway that goes from Assyria up in the north down to Jerusalem, or from Egypt down deep in the south up to Jerusalem. And how there will be people traveling on this highway, bringing themselves to Jerusalem to worship the Lord, and that there will be peace and prosperity along this pathway. Here in Isaiah chapter 35, verse 8, we see the name of this. A highway shall be there. It shall be called the Way of Holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk in the way. Even if they are fools, they shall not go astray. So this is the highway of holiness that is part of the millennial kingdom. It is this holy zone that seems to stretch over the entire promised land and beyond. And it is peace and prosperity all along it. And everybody gets to come to Jerusalem to worship the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. There's no more threats either. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come upon it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. One of the attributes of the millennial period is that all the wild animals go back to their original peacefulness. So there is no threat anymore from them. And there is nothing to be afraid of in this new period of peace under the Prince of Peace. Verse 10, and the ransomed of he who is shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. And we know, again, from other passages, one of the things that disappears in the millennial period is sadness and sorrow and crying and pain. That's all gone. And so I think that these things are all good reasons to believe this section of Isaiah is related particularly to the millennial period of Jesus, but also the second coming and the confrontations that happen shortly before that, all described in the book of Revelation. Well, we've already done chapters 36 through 39 in other historical places. We're now ready to go to the long final section of the book of Isaiah. That's chapters 40 through 66. We don't have any clear anchor date to place this with, so I'm just going to jump in with it here because we will soon be wrapping up the 8th century reign of Hezekiah and move on to Manasseh and afterward. And of course, we'll also be past Isaiah the prophet. So I want to finish his prophetic writings before we move on to the transition from Hezekiah's time. Now, in order to give proper justice to this last section of Isaiah, we have to address an attack from liberal direction against the authorship of Isaiah of this last section. There are many liberal commentators who reject that Isaiah, the 8th century prophet, could have written this last section. And they give you all sorts of reasons for why you should agree with them that this is a totally different person that writes this section. My response is that the Jewish people did not treat this section as being something different than the original part of Isaiah, that is chapters 1 through 39. They believed it was all the same author. Jesus quotes from both sections as if they were the same author. So do other members of the church period. So I think that we should accept it as the same Isaiah writing, all of them. Now, the chief objection of these liberal commentators is that this section of Isaiah includes the naming of Cyrus the Persian many centuries before he was ever born. And of course, the liberals don't believe in prophecy. They don't believe that things like that can be written with such precision until after the events have taken place. So they try to make this section of Isaiah happen after the time of Cyrus the Persian. But myself and others who believe in the power of prophecy, we see no problem with God talking about things of the future as if they're already past, as if they're the present. Because God knows the beginning from the end. He is outside of time. And so as I go through this section, I am going to treat it with the respect I think it is due as the writing of Isaiah the prophet in the 8th century about things that happened centuries later. Chapter number 40, comfort. Comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem. Cry to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity is pardoned, that she has received from he who is his hand double for all her sins. Much of what Isaiah writes from here on out is going to revolve around the judgment of God against Judah and Jerusalem through the Babylonians, the Babylonian exile that followed that judgment, and then the restoration of the people from Babylonian exile back to the land, and the preparations for the coming of the Messiah. A voice cries in the wilderness, prepare the way of he who is, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Now, we were just talking about the highway of holiness a little while ago, but this highway is mentioned in the Gospels as something that John the Immerser was participating in, and that is preparing the way for Jesus to come the first time. Verse 4, every valley shall be lifted up, every mountain and hill made low, the uneven ground shall become level, the rough places a plain, and the glory of he who is shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of he who is has spoken. So the focus here is that Messiah is coming, and that people need to get ready for it. And so Isaiah becomes the prophet here of the first coming of Jesus as our Savior. And John the Immerser becomes the forerunner, crying out in the wilderness, get ready for the King.